From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd, in for Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Trump makes his first trip as president to New Hampshire today after a weekend of political invective following that late Friday night firing of Deputy FBI Director Andrew McCabe. Former CIA Chief John Brennan tweeted to the president, in part, "When the full extent of your venality becomes known, you will take your rightful place as a disgraced demagogue in the dustbin of history." And later, Trump angrily tweeted out about the Russia investigation, naming special counsel Robert Mueller for the first time. But today in New Hampshire, he takes up the opioid addiction crisis. You may recall that on the 2016 campaign trail, he called New Hampshire a drug-infested den and promised help. Today, he'll call for preventing the overprescription of opioids, for more treatment, tougher law enforcement, including possibly the death penalty for dealers. Although there are questions about how all this is going to be paid for. Reporter Paul Steinhauser is covering the trip for the Concord Monitor. Paul, briefly, do you get a sense of people there responding to the turmoil this weekend?
Yeah, and in the predictable ways, those who are supporters of the president, there are plenty of them up here. You know, they back him 100%. You saw the president's tweet just a couple hours ago calling the Mueller investigation a witch hunt. So that's kind of more red meat for his supporters, his base in New Hampshire and elsewhere. And those opposed, it's more ammunition to criticize the president. But I think the bigger point here, and even some allies of the president up here will quietly say they're a little upset that maybe the president this morning is still tweeting about the Mueller investigation because it steps on the message of the day, which is the opioid epidemic. So there's a little bit of disappointment that maybe the president shouldn't have been doing this morning.
Well, let's pay attention to it, despite his tweets. Some of the goals he's laying out: preventing the overprescription of opioids by a third in 3 years, by incentivizing states to move to a national database that monitors prescriptions. And talk about some of the other points he wants to make.
Yep. One of them, of course, has been getting a lot of attention since late last week, and that is the possibility of the death penalty against drug traffickers. I was on a call with the White House last night when they were kind of giving the details of this plan. The White House officials that were on the call were basically deferring to the Justice Department on where and when they would seek the death penalty against certain drug traffickers. But, of course, they mentioned those who are peddling fentanyl, which, as we all know, is about 50 times more lethal than heroin and is at least here in New Hampshire and in other states, really a major cause now for these drug overdoses, that those who are peddling fentanyl could maybe be seeking the death penalty or find the death penalty. Also, something else that's kind of a big deal, Medicaid. Right now, there's a decades-old law that prohibits Medicaid from reimbursing residential treatment at certain facilities. Mm-hmm. The Trump administration is trying to change that. You'll hear the president make those calls today to Congress to try to change that. It's going to need legislative help.
Well, so more punitive actions. He's talking about lowering the threshold amount of drugs sold that can invoke mandatory minimum sentences. But he's arriving in a region that is kind of switching away from punitive action, at least for users, to help. And he's going to be speaking at a firehouse in Manchester where users can go for help. But the treatment center that fire department officials worked with closed because it was overwhelmed, underfunded. What's the president going to say about money?
Unfortunately, it doesn't seem like he's going to say a lot about money. And one of the big issues up here is changing the federal funding formula. Right now, we have $1 billion that's being distributed across the country to states across the country through the 21st Century Cures Act. And about $6 billion more is expected on its way if Congress acts this week. The problem is, for states like New Hampshire, which has the third highest drug overdose rate per capita in the country, the federal funding formula is not per capita. It's just on overall numbers. And our Republican governor up here, as well as the state's entire Democratic delegation, congressional delegation, has been urging the administration to change the federal funding formula to help states that are real hardest hit, like us, Massachusetts, and a bunch of others, Ohio, West Virginia.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
We don't expect to hear that from the president today, and we don't also expect to hear anything about additional funding.
Look, let's wrap up where we began with a political question. As you mentioned, President Trump has a lot of supporters in New Hampshire. We spoke with many of them during the last primary. A University of New Hampshire poll last month found 60% of Republican primary voters plan to vote for Trump in 2020. That number's gone up since October. But then there was an event on Friday. Retiring Arizona Senator and Trump critic Jeff Flake got a standing ovation when he said, "Fellow Republicans need to speak out against Donald Trump and run against him if necessary." Now, Flake did not say that he's running, but this is, you know, the season for the 2020 election in your state. What are the chances? What are people saying about a Republican presidential primary in 2020?
Yeah, there is an appetite for it up here. It's still small, but it could grow larger. Stay tuned on that. You'll see more Republicans visiting up here with the possibility or the hint of a primary challenge.
They just happen to be in New Hampshire. Paul Steinhauser reports for the Concord Monitor. Thanks, Paul.
Have a great day, Robin.
Now to Russia, where there's news from a very different election.
Moskva! Россия! Наш лидер! Владимир Путин!
It was a triumphant night for Vladimir Putin, who easily won his fourth term yesterday with nearly 77% of the vote. His most serious rival, Alexei Navalny, was barred from running because of a fraud conviction, which was widely seen as politically motivated. NPR's Lucian Kim joins us from Yekaterinburg, Russia's fourth largest city, about 1,000 miles east of Moscow. And Lucian, no one really surprised by this result, but Putin's share of the vote, 77%, was his highest ever. What's the reaction where you are?
Well, actually, mostly shrugs. I mean, as you said, everybody expected him to win. And during the campaign, we heard that the Kremlin was aiming for a 70% result. And now Putin seems to have topped even that. So, of course, Putin's entourage is celebrating. And his spokesman said today that the results show that Russian society is consolidated to a maximum degree.
Did he say anything about what his future plans were? Because now he's in office for another 6 years.
I think the reason people voted for him wasn't so much because of any particular plan. It's much more connected to his personality and this idea that he and only he can maintain the status quo. One man here in Yekaterinburg had a very smart explanation. He said, "Russians just don't want things to get any worse, while you Americans always expect things to get better."
Hmm. Well, Putin also seemed to be making some kind of a statement at that rally last night. It was held actually to also mark the anniversary of Russia's annexation of Crimea in 2014. And there, you know, there is some speculation, Lucian, that this victory will embolden him to increase his conflicts with the West. I mean, from what you can see there where you are, is there any truth to that?
Well, definitely. Putin has been playing up this idea that Russia is a besieged fortress. So this kind of high result definitely gives him sort of the backing to pursue whatever policies he wants to going forward.
Hmm. What about the opposition? Alexei Navalny, we mentioned his name, the main opposition leader there in Russia, wasn't even able to run against him. You got to wonder what the race would have looked like if he had been involved. Where does this leave Putin's opponents?
In a very bad place. Alexei Navalny is telling his supporters not to be disillusioned, since if they followed his advice to boycott the election, they wouldn't have participated in what he's calling a charade. Last night, Navalny and the liberal presidential candidate, Ksenia Sobchak, who picked up less than 2% of the vote, held a debate on Navalny's YouTube channel. And she kind of reached out with an olive branch and offered to unite forces. And Navalny flatly refused. He called her a Putin tool and said he couldn't forgive her for participating in the elections. That made a very poor picture. I've spoken to many people over the past few months who are against the government, but they don't see Navalny or anybody else really as a realistic, viable alternative who could lead the country. And that's why many people ended up voting for Putin.
So he called for that boycott, didn't really seem to work, but were there any reports of fraud or, you know, evidence that there had been, you know, efforts to swing the election in Putin's favor?
Yes. Navalny's people have reported harassment of election monitors, ballot stuffing, and even some isolated incidents of violence. But there are other levers that the government has, which Russians call administrative resources. And these are much more effective than ballot stuffing. I think the best examples are the way the Russian government controls the media and things like mandatory attendance at elections for state employees. Because the assumption is once people are already there at the polling station, they'll go ahead and vote for Putin. So it'd be wrong to say that there was somehow mass vote rigging and that's the only way Putin won. It's really a whole system that's tipped in favor of Putin.
So last week, right before this vote, you know, there were so many headlines. You had the Trump administration announcing sanctions against Russia because of interference in the U.S. election. There was also the diplomatic row with Prime Minister Theresa May, who kicked out 23 Russian diplomats after the U.K. had accused Russia of being involved in the attempted murder of the former Russian spy in Salisbury. How much of that affected the vote on Sunday? Were Russians thinking about those tensions when they went to the polls?
Well, a lot of people are saying that now. I mean, the view from Moscow is really the polar opposite of the one in the U.S. or Europe, namely that the West is bullying Russia and only Putin can stand up to the rest of the world. Almost anything the West does is being used as a propaganda coup here. If there are new sanctions, well, that's just proof that the whole world is against us. And if there's some kind of relaxation in relations, well, that's evidence that Putin's tough stance is really working.
That's NPR's Lucian Kim reporting from Yekaterinburg, Russia. Lucian, thank you so much.
Thanks, Peter.
There's another march calling for more school safety and gun control this coming Saturday in Washington, another response to the Parkland school shooting. But there's also InfoWars host Alex Jones, leading conspiracy theorists who deny the shooting ever happened. In fact, he called the teenage survivor David Hogg a crisis actor. He made similar claims about Brennan Gilmore, who filmed the violence at that white supremacist rally in Charlottesville. Now Brennan is suing Jones. We'll speak with him tomorrow. And Jones' followers have also been berating members of the First Baptist Church in Sutherland Springs, Texas, who lost 26 fellow parishioners in that mass shooting in November, including the 14-year-old daughter of the pastor. The conspiracy theorists accuse church members of being part of a vast red flag operation run by the federal government carried out by crisis actors. Pastor Frank Pomeroy and his wife Sherry join us now, and we are so sorry for your loss, Annabelle. And now this. Look, this couple has been arrested. What were they saying to you?
Well, they have been coming to the neighborhood ever since day one, for the most part, and accusing all the neighbors, the parishioners, everyone involved, that we are all traitors to our country because we are trying to carry out a Department of Homeland Security drill to entice the rest of the country to have to live in fear, and that none of our family members or loved ones have existed, that this was all made up, and that we are all, each one of us individually, working together some overall plot against America.
These are Jody Mann and Robert Usery. They're not the only ones doing this, but they believe, as others do, that 33 tragedies are all fake, all part of this vast government's conspiracy. And by the way, this is propagated by Alex Jones. I know you found yourself having to have a confrontation with these two conspiracy theorists because they were writing what on the whiteboard outside your church?
We did not choose to integrate ourselves with these people. They unfortunately engaged with us. The other day, they got out to deface one of the posters from one of the well-wishers that we have hanging on our fence, and I was able to step out of my vehicle, and that's when the berating and the hollering and everything else started on me at that point.
Had you known about this, Pastor, that this has happened to the Sandy Hook parents, to others, and again, it's propagated by the Alex Jones?
To be honest, I remember during Sandy Hook hearing about people who were denying the validity and the reality of what had happened up in Sandy Hook. However, I guess I've never put much credence in those kinds of things and never really listened to it. So I didn't realize just how serious these people can be and how vicious actually these people can be when they come down and try to prove their alternate reality.
Well, it's all about their belief that this is a plot to take away guns. What has happened post this horror at your church and the loss of your child, as you know, is different from what we're seeing post Parkland. You're more of a gun-owning community. In fact, I understand that you carry a gun to your church every Sunday legally, and you gave one to Sherry for Christmas.
That is true. Guns are just a part of who we are in South Texas, and carrying a sidearm is not something unusual. The ideology that came out of Parkland just would never remotely grow legs down here in South Texas, I don't believe.
Can you explain that, you know, the culture of deer hunting and self-protection? But can you explain that to people, you know, how you feel this is protecting you when there are people who feel, you know, a gun in a church might be the problem?
Correct. So when you look at South Texas, we do look at firearms in general as something, as you just said, utilized for hunting, self-protection. When I was confronting these people, I had about a very tense 15 minutes with this gentleman while I was waiting on law enforcement to get there. Now, luckily, he wasn't armed and doing anything silly, pulling a sidearm. However, if he had of, I would have been able to defend myself at that point in that 15 minutes waiting on law enforcement to get there.
But is it complicated, your feeling about this thing that you feel will protect you but also took so many lives?
No, I am not one that is an avid person, right or left. I believe there are some sensible gun control issues that need to be debated and brought forth. However, I don't believe that taking away the right of owning a sidearm is something that should be thought on either.
When you say sidearm, you know, a pistol, well, how do you feel about rifles that can be made to fire rapid fire like assault rifles? Should there be more restrictions on them?
Well, I am one of the few that do believe that there's not much use for automatic weapons in the hands of civilians. I understand there is the hog populations and such where they utilize those kinds of weapons. But I also understand, too, the fear of that being a first step. If folks was to say, oh, yes, we're going to relent and allow the semi-automatic weapons to be taken from us, the next step is going to be our sidearms. I don't really buy into that mantra. Therefore, my personal opinion is that we probably do not need the military assault style rifles. That's coming from a hunter. I have 23 rifles, different styles, and I do not own an assault rifle. I see no point in it for me.
Why would you want to tear apart a deer, you know, if you're going to...
Exactly.
Yeah. What would you like to see?
We have a mental health crisis in this country. I believe that should be addressed. That should be the primary focus over the sidearms. The gentleman that I was having to confront in the beginning, I believed him probably just wanting attention and or notoriety of some sort. However, once engaging with him for 15 minutes, I realized by looking into his eyes, he not only believes some of the things he's saying, but you could just see that he's not engaging with the real world the way everyone else is. And that's the kind of things that need to be addressed, I think, more than the gun control issues.
Can I speak with Sherry?
You sure may.
Yeah.
This is Sherry.
I'm just wondering, Sherry, how have you felt to have this element, you know, you're going through this, having lost a child and all these friends, and have this horror come into your church, and then these people come and tell you it's not true?
Yes, ma'am. It's been just a nightmare. They're just opening wounds and pouring salt in.
Yeah, I can't imagine. And then I'm wondering, too, another shooting, and the response to the shooting at Parkland, the marches, you see these kids.
Well, I've purposely tried to not watch any of that because it's just too fresh and too raw right now. Yeah. So I've been so busy trying to heal and get our life back to some kind of normal. You just learn to go on. One day, not even one day at a time, one breath at a time. I mean, you can be just, you know, smiling one minute and something will hit you, a memory will come, and that's it. It's just, you know, we all lost a lot of friends and family, and we're just muddling through one breath at a time.
Yeah. And again, we're struck by how these are two very different communities wrestling with this. In Parkland, parents and children are calling for more gun control, banning assault weapons, tighter background checks. Here you are in a gun culture, and we're seeing that Frank gave you one for Christmas, and you were a little ambivalent about this. I mean, it was for self-protection, but...
Well, it's a new world for us. Our whole world has changed. I've never been a person of fear. We live in a community where it's not uncommon to leave your house unlocked if you run down the road or your car's unlocked. And when you go into Walmart, we just live in a small, safe town where we feel comfortable. And it's turned it upside down to where the new normal is I feel safer to be carrying a gun, where before it never crossed my mind, but now it's become more personal.
Mm. So things have changed for you in another way. But as you fend off these conspiracy theorists, how can other people help you? How can people outside Sutherland, whether or not they believe in people carrying guns, you know, whether they disagree with that, how can they help you?
Just stop going to their sites and giving them credence, because that's, you know, what keeps them going.
Yeah. But I mean, also just help you all heal in general. Do you want to tell us about Annabelle? Is it better not to speak of her? What do you need?
No, I do need to speak, and we have a support group, and we talk, and it's a slow process. Some people are still at the very beginning of the grief process. Some people are, you know, a little farther along, and we've got to be respectful not to push each other past what we can handle.
You've stayed away, and understandably, from watching the Parkland kids and all the kids across the country marching, but many of them are holding signs for all the young victims of guns, and that includes your daughter, Annabelle.
Yes, but we're trying not to focus on her manner of death in our grieving process, because like my husband has stated, you know, it wasn't the gun that killed her. Somebody pulled a trigger, and that's, I believe, is a mental health issue. So if we don't get a hold of the mental health issue, then we've not done a good service.
That's Sherry Pomeroy with her husband Frank of the First Baptist Church of Sutherland Springs, Texas, still recovering after a mass shooter killed 26 of their parishioners, including their daughter Annabelle. Again, so sorry. And again, now conspiracy theorists are telling them it wasn't real. Sherry, Frank, thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you for having us on.
The trial of Nora Salmon, the wife of the Pulse nightclub murderer, is underway in Orlando, Florida. She's charged with lying to the FBI and aiding and abetting her husband, who killed 49 people and wounded 53 others in June 2016 before dying in a shootout with police. Nora Salmon faces life in prison if she's convicted. WMFE reporter Amy Green is in Orlando. And Amy, two very different portraits are emerging of Nora Salmon. There's no recording of the FBI questioning when they first picked her up. But what proof is the prosecution offering that she knew?
Right. Well, as you said, at the heart of this trial is this FBI statement that Nora Salmon gave to FBI agents in the hours after this 2016 mass shooting. And during the course of that statement, she said many things. But among the things she said is that she was sorry about what happened and that she wished she could go back and tell his family and the police about what he was planning to do. So this FBI statement is really the crux of prosecutor's case. And so obviously defense is doing everything they can to tear the statement apart.
Well, the prosecution is also saying that she scouted the locations with her husband, but the defense points to the fact that the night of the shooting, and this is chilling, he used Google to find the club. And they say, so how could she know? What else were they saying in her defense?
So the defense is saying a few things. They in their opening arguments, painted Nora Salmon. They used the word simple to describe her. They said that she has an IQ in the 80s and is not really someone who was capable of understanding this kind of planning. You mentioned a defense motion that insinuated that the Pulse mass shooting was kind of a spur of the moment, last minute thing that actually Omar Mateen, the gunman, before arriving at Pulse, had scouted Disney Springs, had scouted another nightclub in Orlando, and that forensic evidence, cell phone evidence, that kind of thing supports that.
She's also saying that she's a victim of domestic violence. How does that affect the case?
That will be an interesting aspect of the case. Nora Salmon, she's a victim of domestic violence, and so it's possible that the defense will suggest that her abuse somehow caused her to feel coerced into helping with the plans, although now this defense motion is insinuating this was a last minute this was a last minute thing. So it's likely that domestic violence will be an issue in the trial.
Look, Amy, just a minute left here, but Pulse survivors have been in the courtroom. It's been brutal. I mean, video from security cameras and police cameras at the horror are being shown. How are people reacting to this? I mean, this has got to be tough.
It's very emotional. This trial comes nearly 2 years after this mass shooting. For survivors and family members who are there in the courtroom, it gives them a first opportunity to see Noor Salmin, to see the wife of the Pulse gunman in person. Mm-hmm. And I know from having talked to some of them that that itself was a difficult thing. Mm-hmm. I'm also hearing different reactions from different family members and survivors. I've heard some say the trial is very important in helping them ascertain some answers as to why. Others will not be watching closely.
Amy Green of WMFE, thank you.
Shares of Facebook fell more than 7% after markets opened today as backlash against the company continues over its role in a massive data leak. A report over the weekend in the New York Times revealed that UK-based Cambridge Analytica used data from 50 million Facebook accounts to help influence the 2016 U.S. presidential election. Facebook has reportedly known about the data leak for 2 years, but revelations from a Cambridge Analytica co-founder, Christopher Wiley, helped uncover the extent of what the company had done. Here's Wiley speaking with Channel 4 News in the UK, explaining his former company's relationship to the Trump campaign's chief executive, Steve Bannon.
Steve wanted weapons for his culture war. That's what he wanted. We offered him a way to accomplish what he wanted to do, which was change the culture of America.
All right, let's untangle this story with Derek Thompson. He's senior editor at The Atlantic, and he joins us now from New York. Derek, thanks for being here.
Great to be here. Thanks.
Sure. So Christopher Wiley says Steve Bannon wanted to use this company to change the culture of America. How did they try to do that?
I'm going to try to make this as simple as possible. Cambridge Analytica is a data analytics company, so-called Cambridge because the tech was pioneered at Cambridge University, so-called Analytica because they use social media data to build personality profiles of consumers. They figure out who people are, what they like, and then they sell that information so that marketers can sell stuff to consumers. But there's all these tendrils that connect Cambridge Analytica to the Trump campaign, and I'll quickly run through three. Mm-hmm. First, as you suggested, the company was founded by Robert Mercer, the billionaire patron of Steve Bannon and other alt-right causes. Second, we know the Trump's digital team used Cambridge Analytica to help them target voters online. And then three, one of the company's consultants we now know was Michael Flynn, the former national security advisor who was fired. And there was concern in the Mueller investigation that might connect Flynn and Cambridge Analytica to Russian propaganda. We'll get to that later. But basically, even before we get to today's news, Cambridge Analytica should be thought of as the digital scaffolding of Trump's digital campaign.
So it's fascinating and it is complicated. But in order to do all of this, it needs data. And so as this story and the reporting goes, they connect with a psychologist who creates an app. The app is called This Is Your Digital Life. And Derek, that is the source of data from 50 million Facebook users?
Yeah, it sounds impossible, but again, let me try to walk us through it as slowly as possible. So when you log into a new app, let's say it's a weather app or a Bitcoin app, dating app, it often prompts you to log in through Facebook, right? You can say, you know, you can create a username password or you can log in through Facebook. When you click log in through Facebook, it essentially allows that app and that app's developers to see certain information that Facebook is holding on to you. But what's more, for many years, it also allowed developers to get information about all of your friends.
Hmm.
So when you logged in, lots of friends that had open privacy protocols would actually sort of passively share information with this developer. So what seems to have happened is that, as you said, a Cambridge University professor created a personality survey. He got a couple hundred thousand people to create accounts, but he was also collecting data, scraping together all of their friend networks, such that you got tens of millions of people in total. And he shared that information with Cambridge Analytica to build, so that they could build essentially psychographic profiles of users that we think might have been used in the Trump digital campaign.
Okay, so let's get into that. This psychographic modeling. They start to collect this data from not only you, but from your friends who have inadvertently allowed Facebook to give them this information, most
That's
likely.
Right.
How did they then take all that data and use it to potentially influence the election?
There are three ways that they may have used this data. First, super conventionally, they probably just used it the same way that lots of data analytics firms would use their data, which is, all right, let's find a bunch of people who have a certain personality trait. Let's say paranoia, for example. We can identify people who present as paranoid through their psychographic data. Let's make a paranoid advertisement on Facebook about, let's say, gun rights, and then let's target people that present as paranoid. Okay, that's pretty simple. That's number one.
Mm-hmm.
Number two, it seems like Cambridge Analytica also determined which Facebook messages were working and where so that they could sort of move Trump's travel schedule around it. So if a certain post seemed to get a lot of attention in some, you know, random Wisconsin town, okay, boom, let's send Trump to Wisconsin.
Wow.
Now, third, and by far the most controversial, is the question of whether the Trump campaign shared this data, shared these personality psychographic profiles with the Russians, so that the Russians and their propagandists could also target people who, say, presented as anti-Hillary Clinton or extremely paranoid or had some other element that emerged through the profile that they could see through Facebook data.
And that's what the Mueller investigation
that Mueller,
is. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Mueller is investigating that right now.
Facebook is getting just slammed over this. We mentioned the stocks fell about 7%, the share value, at the open today. Facebook posted a response on its site. It said that the claims that this is a data breach are completely false and that people knowingly provided their information when they downloaded this app to take the personality quiz. But isn't that misleading, Derek? If so many people didn't download the app and didn't say that they, you know, wanted their data scrubbed, you know, is Facebook being fair here?
Facebook, I think, is playing a bit of a dangerous game of nuance here. What they're saying is this wasn't technically a data breach. It was a legal use of Facebook data by a bad actor. And now, from Facebook's perspective, they've said now we've kicked off Cambridge Analytica because they're a bad actor. But in a way, this argument makes Facebook look even worse. Because what they're essentially saying is we created an infrastructure that allowed people to essentially act in such a way as to steal people's information.
Hmm.
So that's essentially saying, like, as I think so much of Facebook's excuses in the last 6 months are essentially saying, we built a highway and we didn't build any sort of police force on that highway. So if people speed, now that's their fault. But in fact, you know, when you build a highway, you're also supposed to pay for a police force to make sure that people use that bit of infrastructure in a way that is healthy and doesn't hurt people. And I think that over and over again in the last 6 months, really the last, I guess, year and a half, my issue with Facebook's excuses is that they're constantly saying essentially that people used our information, used our app too well, but they did so with nefarious purposes.
Well, speaking of oversight, obviously this has the attention of lawmakers. I want to hear a little bit now from U.S. Senator Amy Klobuchar, who said over the weekend that Mark Zuckerberg should appear before the Senate Judiciary Committee.
I think that the CEOs have to take responsibility, come before us, and explain to us what exactly happened, what is the extent of the damage, and how are you going to fix it so it doesn't happen again.
But Derek, here is my question. So maybe there's oversight after all of this, but what about the user of Facebook and social media? Why are we surprised? Why are people up in arms? We open our lives to social media. Many of us do every single day. We put public information out there. Should it really be any big surprise that this has happened?
I have to stress this point again. In so many ways, this is exactly how Facebook was meant to be used. Facebook was meant to be extremely useful to app developers, to encourage them to develop ever more sophisticated apps off the Facebook platform. And giving these app developers access to psychographic personality data of potential users and
right.
those users' networks.
Like, what were people expecting when they took
exactly,
that quiz?
Exactly. They essentially were promising these app developers as much utility as possible. And so in many ways, yes, Facebook is right. It's not a data breach. It's a bad actor, but Facebook also has to look itself in the mirror and recognize that they have built a platform that accelerates and amplifies the nefarious purposes of bad actors. And understanding that, they then have to go back to the drawing board, I think, and say, how do we want to develop a worldwide information protocol such that it is useful to families and friends, but also doesn't encourage bad actors to act in this way?
All right, complicated but important story. Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic. Thanks for helping us out with it.
Thank you.
Let's listen to a bit of a recent BBC broadcast.
Nigeria Senate President Dr. Bukola Saraki de Ghana now. And guess what he give the Ghana president?
Naija Jollof.
No. Saraki give President Nana Akufo-Addo ostrich egg. We get
my... What? I heard ostrich egg. Yes, the BBC World Service, one of our producing partners, is expanding with 10 new language services in Africa and Asia. Among them, as we heard, West African Pigeon. The West African Pigeon website debuted about 6 months ago. There's some irony here because the BBC was part of a push by the colonizing British government to get people to speak English. We'll get to that. Adejua Shirinka is editor of the BBC Pigeon Service in Lagos, Nigeria. Adejua, we hear the most widely spoken form of West African Pigeon is Nigerian Pigeon, 75 million speakers.
Yes, you're right. When you add that to pidgin speakers in Ghana, in Cameroon, in Sierra Leone, in Senegal, across West and Central Africa, you can imagine the huge population of audience that the BBC is directly catering to.
Sure. Well, we know the word pidgin because it also has come to mean, you know, put together a little bit of this, a little bit of that. And that's what happened with this language. Remind us where it came from.
Well, you know, pidgin came way back from the 17th century, an attempt to create a common language between the English speakers and the locals. So it's a mixture of English and local languages across the different port cities that they visited across the region.
This is when the British came, but we understand there was actually even a little bit of it when the Portuguese traders came in the 15th century, but it evolved. And I find it so interesting because, you know, the British colonists who wanted to have this way of communicating, and so this language evolved. They then tried to teach English in the schools. Some of the students, we understand, started speaking pidgin as a resistance against having to speak just English.
Yes. When you talk about the protest side of the language, you look at musicians like Fela Anikulapo Kuti, who sang a lot of his songs in pidgin, rebelling against colonial authorities in that sense.
Fela Kuti, the Nigerian musician, he sang a famous song, Gentleman, in pidgin. And again, it was a rejection of this notion that he had to become westernized. He sings, I no be gentleman at all.
I no be gentleman at all. I no be gentleman at all at all.
I no be gentleman at all. I no be gentleman at all. I no be gentleman at all. The African man, original. That was Bella Nicola Pokuti. But more than that, it's also a function of the fact that this region is a multi-ethnic region. In Nigeria, you have over 250 languages. So Pidgin comes across as that language that can unify the whole country. So if you want to rise above the multi-ethnic dialect, if you want to rise above the colonial influence, Pidgin comes to you as a language to speak. So you find that even government tries to push out public announcements and all of that in Pidgin.
Tell us a little more about how the language works. Can you give us some examples?
For instance, if I wanted to greet you now, I could say, hey, how you dey? Wetin dey happen for your side now? How President Donald Trump dey? Make you now dey greet am for me. Tell us how dey true inside.
What'd you say?
Can you translate that?
Yeah.
Oh, well, so what I've just said to you is, how are you? How are you doing? What's happening? How's the U.S. President, President Donald Trump, you know, how's he doing? Tell him I say hello.
Well, we have to ask you about the headline on the BBC World Service, Pidgin Service, that got everybody's attention. It had to do with the woman who, well, it's the poo-poo story, is how everybody refers to it.
Yeah.
Could you read the headline?
The poo-poo story. Kuma we want to wear poo-poo, con trap for window.
And it was a story about?
Oh, yeah. You know, the story was about a lady who she used the bathroom and was going to, I don't know, for whatever reason, she decided to throw the excreta out through the window. And it got trapped in the window. And then she tried to reach for it. And then she also got trapped. And the boyfriend she was trying to impress had to be called in to rescue her, and he couldn't, and then had to call in the fire service, and it became really very messy. Got a lot of attention.
Yes, I'll say.
But that's not the only story that's got us a lot of attention, you know. We did a story about the Nigerian president. He'd been out of the country, then he just came back. And unfortunately, the president, who had been away for about 3 months, couldn't work in his office. So we found out why the president was not at work, and we were told rodents had taken over his office while he was
rodents,
in.
Rats. He
hit for, yeah, rodents in Pidgin, that's rat. So we did the story of how rat chased President Buhari come out from office. And boom, that became the talk of the town. And of course, we've gone ahead to do great stories after that. We've done stories that impacted greatly on our audiences. I mean, recently we did a story on three Ghanaian girls who are autistic, but have decided to rise above the autism challenge, and they are now models.
They're models.
And now they are brand ambassadors, you know, in Ghana, and they're doing very well. And the story has gone so viral. In about 2-3 months, we've got close to 3 million views on our Facebook page. So the reception has been quite good, and we've gone ahead to do great stories as well. It's just a major game changer.
Well, we wish you the best. Adejuan Srinka, editor of the BBC Pidgin in Lagos, Nigeria, thank you so much.
Thank you. I appreciate your time.
And here now is a production of NPR and WBUR and the BBC. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. It's Here and Now.